Hello, guys. Welcome back to the Metamoon podcast. It's Emily here. Today, I have an incredible conversation to share with you on the topic of death. I sat down with my friend Caroline Lee. She is a photographer and a producer based in Los Angeles, and she has been training to become a death doula for the past year. If you don't know what a death doula is, you're about to find out. I do want to warn you, though, this episode is heavy. We talk about death the whole time, so if that might be triggering for you, you might want to listen just a little bit at a time, maybe with some dance breaks, listen with a friend, just be gentle and listen to what you need. Okay. Before we jump in, I want to talk about a few things. First, you can always watch the video recordings of these interviews on my YouTube channel if seeing faces is something you're into. So subscribe to Metamoon on YouTube if you haven't already. And secondly, I have a club, the Existential Crisis Club. As a member, you get access to the private podcast, which includes exclusive guided meditations and some more in-depth resources to help you on your healing journey. And you get access to discussion threads with the community. You can ask me questions. You get early access to my content. It's great for people who want to go deeper into topics like mental health and meditation and spiritual awakening. And it's only $5 a month. So to join the club, go to patreon.com/metamoon. All right, let's jump into my chat with Caroline Lee. Here we are in our sweaty space.
Pandemic pod.
Deep and sweaty and vulnerable.
I'm so ready. If I start getting moist on my dress, you'll know it's because it's like 100 degrees in here right now.
Yeah. It's real hot in here.
Yeah.
Well, before anyone gets angry at us for not being 6 feet apart, everyone should know that we're in a pod.
We're
together.
In a pod. Yeah.
And it's good.
We're pod coming out good. Pod.
we're pod people. We've been podding, and so we're in our social distancing together space. And yeah, I thought it would be good to talk about death, because that's something that's a big topic right now that we're all being forced to confront and deal with and process, and that's something that you have devoted a lot of time and energy to studying and learning. So why don't we start with you just telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do and the whole death work thing, how you got into that, so we can get a little taste of who Caroline is.
Wow, big question. So I'm Caroline. I'm a photographer, and I have been a photographer for, I don't know, 12 years or something like that. A couple of years ago, I was talking to a friend, and he was in the middle of processing some stuff about his grandpa getting ready to die, and he was talking about older people and how, you know, there isn't a lot of care for them around their end of life. And I was like, wow, that's so interesting. I've never really thought of that before. And he mentioned someone that that did a lot of work around death, and was a death doula. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. I've never even heard of that word before. But he was like, yeah, this is her website. And so I looked her up, and I was like, oh, I actually know her. We actually did like a course together like 4 years ago, and I literally didn't know she did death work. I just thought she was really cool. So I was looking at her website. She wrote about doing this thing like advanced directives, and I was like, I don't even know what that is, but that's cool. And I was digging more, realizing that an advanced directive is something where you basically write out your wishes before anything happens to you, specifically around like medical wishes. So a will is like your assets, your home, your money, things like that. Advanced directive is more like, if I'm on life support, like pull the plug, or at my funeral, I want to have an open casket, things like that, you wouldn't necessarily think about probably on like a normal Friday in Los Angeles in the summertime, but it causes so much people stress if there's an unplanned death, or even if there is a death that you can see coming, but you haven't had those conversations. Mm-hmm. It's like so much more of a stressor for family to suddenly be like, what would they have wanted? I don't know. I think she would have wanted this. No, I think she would have wanted that. So as I was reading on this website about death doulas and advanced directives, I had this thought, oh my gosh, I need to get my siblings to fill these out with me, because my family is huge. And if something happened to any one of us, then we would all fight so much about what this person would have wanted, because there's literally, you know, seven of us that would be talking about the one person, not to mention partners and friends and everybody else getting involved. So I was like, I just want to get everyone in the same room writing this down. And so that was really like my entry point into being a normal photographer doing my life, to like, oh, death, interesting. Like, I haven't even considered this, and I'm healthy and well, so what's wrong with me that suddenly I want my siblings to get together and talk about death? But actually, in this very space, at that very table, got all my siblings together. We like got carryout tacos and sat down and wrote out our advanced directives like three years ago. And some of them were more happy about it than others. Yeah. For a couple of them, they were like, what are you making me do? But we did it. And then it really wasn't until a year after that that I really started to think about, you know, death is something that is really a part of our world. It's a part of our cycle of life. And we don't really talk about it. We don't really think about it. We kind of put it behind closed doors. We kind of say, you know, oh, it's like someone's sick and dying, like, oh, they have, you know, whether it's cancer or whatever, it's like, oh, like visit them maybe like once a week. But it brings up a lot to talk to that person. So it's easier to just kind of avoid and just like send them flowers and hope they're okay. But we don't really engage with it as a culture. We don't really, we're not with each other around death or grief or dying. And so I was like, bring it on. I love things that are uncomfortable. I love challenging things. I love having conversations that make people squirm a little bit.
Sort of like Enneagram 8.
Yes, coming in. Yes, yeah. I'm like, ooh, this makes people uncomfortable. Let's go there. So yeah. Whether it's like sex or, you know, money, I was like, death. It's like the final frontier that I haven't really dug at. And so that was kind of my entry point of like, okay, I'm going to do the work to become a death doula, start studying, do a course, doing hospice volunteering. So just getting like what's there, and like, how can I be with death and also then support others in their own mortality? And hopefully just like, what does it look like to be with each other around death, and to be willing to be with ourselves around death? Hopefully meaning that our lives are more meaningful, and that we're willing to be more vulnerable and intimate with each other in like the real stuff. So yeah, that was a really long answer, but that was sort of just like,
oh, that's perfect.
Going from photography to me now.
Doing that now. So now you're actively doing it, or you're studying to become that. What does that process look like to become a death doula, and where are you at in that process?
Yeah. Well, there isn't a ton of like, I guess, it's not like you go to get a degree and then, you know, you finish 4 years of school and then you get a degree. It's like there are a few requirements, and there's like a test. You can be like certified. But for the most part, a lot of it is just around like, do I feel comfortable around it? Have I taken enough courses, read enough books, watched enough films, done shadowing so that I feel like I can, you know, really hold space for someone? Because I don't want to walk into a room and be there answering questions for people going, what do I do? How do I handle this? If I still am not sure.
And what does that work look like practically? What do you do as a death doula?
There's a very long list of things that a death doula can do. Sometimes it's very simple, like someone who's just comfortable around death. So if there's someone, let's say, at home in hospice, and they can't go to the store to do their groceries, and maybe they don't have family or friends, or maybe their family and friends aren't comfortable being around someone who's at their end of life, I might go do grocery shopping for them and come home and be with them, be around them. It might be someone who communicates in between a medical team and the patient, like what their wishes are. Because sometimes, you know, especially if you're in a hospital, there can be doctors changing shifts all the time. They're coming in and out. And so to have the patient have to communicate with every single doctor that's coming in and out of the room in one shift to the next, it can be exhausting. And so it can be, I can just be the one that's like, I'll communicate with the medical team. And then if they're wondering, do you know what they would have wanted? Do you know, like, how's their pain level? Those sorts of things. Then I can be the one, the one to sort of take one less thing for them to have to think about and communicate.
Yeah, just supporting, taking some of the pressure off of everybody involved in a really difficult time.
So difficult.
That seems so obviously needed, but then yet it's something that most people listening probably have never heard of that or knew that that's an option, but it seems like very important
space. Yeah, and even for people who are healthy still, thinking about getting their affairs in order is so huge. And it's really shocking. Like, I think it was maybe Aretha Franklin, someone who died really recently and literally, like, didn't have a will. Like, people who are old, people who have a lot of money, people who, like, air quotes, like, should know better, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, did you not realize that that was a possibility?
Yeah.
And yet, it's not like there's a class on it, you know? Like, hopefully most of us got some form of sex ed growing up. Hopefully if a woman gets pregnant, she's going to go to a birthing class or she's going to have a lactation consultant. We're not, yes, we have an instinct. Our bodies know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, my body knows how to die, even though I don't, I can't tell my body how to die, but my body knows.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we as a culture know how to be with each other in death. And so I would love for there to be, like, literally, like, a mandatory, you know, like, junior year of high school, you go through, like, death class.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Like, what, how cool would that be to just normalize it, to understand it, to ask the questions, to see how death is all around us, whether it's our pets, plants, relationships, like, everything dies.
Yeah.
And how cool would it be if we were willing to be with that and actually see, ooh, what comes up around that, and how can we grieve and be in this really uncomfortable, potentially uncomfortable, like, shadow space? What's there? So anyway, that gets me very excited.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that we're so resistant to it and we ignore it so much? Is it just the fear of dying, or what makes us do that as a culture?
I think it's because we don't know what happened. There's no control. And so for humans, you know, we survive through the at least illusion of control. If I know, like, oh, I have eggs in the fridge, and when I get home, I can make myself an omelet for dinner, I'm not going to be like, where am I going to eat next? And suddenly, like, be out, like, trying to find, you know, an orange tree to get food from. It's just, it's like this sense of knowing. And I think because death is one big, huge question mark for all of us. And different religions have different practices that bring some sort of knowing where, you know, here's the answer to whatever it is that you're not sure of. And some people really, really, really buy into that, and that makes them feel really safe and secure. But honestly, even those people on their deathbeds are usually like,
really afraid.
Has what I've believed, is that real?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know. We don't know. That's the thing. And so many people can say, I know, I know, I know. Yeah, sure. Maybe you do. Maybe you don't. And so I think death brings up a lot for people because there's no control. You don't know when you're going to die. I don't know when I'm going to die. And also, we don't know what happens after that. So there's just the lack of, like, agency and, like, I own my life and I can say what happens. Like, no, I'm sorry. Like, Steve Jobs, for all the money in the world, is not here in his body anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's facing the fact that we don't ever have control or security. And I think that I was reading some stuff out of this Alan Watts book called Wisdom of Insecurity recently, because I was like, found it on the shelf and was like, oh, I think this is probably relevant to right now. And I was reading some stuff in it that really hit with me about religion and why people do that, brings security of thinking about, okay, after I die, this will happen to me. It brings that sense of control in, but because we don't want to face the fact that not only do we not know what's going to happen when we die, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. And so a lot of times our happiness is based on this promise of more happiness. And so we can't be in this moment enjoying what we have right now fully unless we have some sense of control that that's going to continue on, or we're going to get more of that later. And without that, we're freaking out, which is kind of what's happening right now, because everybody's so anxious because we don't know how long this is going to go on. We don't know how many people are going to die. We don't know what's going to happen. And that's making us have to face that discomfort, which is very related to death, I feel, which is it's the loss of control. It's the loss of security that we, with all our systems and our jobs and our homes, makes us feel like, oh, I have control over my life. I have security in my life. Which we don't.
We don't. We don't. But it's very hard to sit with that.
Yeah.
I talked to my therapist friend this morning who lives in Chicago, and she told me that anxiety medication use has gone up 34% since the beginning of the pandemic. And depression medication has gone up 18%. But yeah, totally. Like, sitting with that it's brutal.
Yeah.
It's really, really brutal. And most people don't want to do it. And some people are willing to, but usually, typically, they're pretty fringe weirdos. Like, mm-hmm. They're like, oh yeah, the people who like meditate for 6 hours a day or are like totally chill being, you know, gurus and, you know, doing all sorts of the things that we normal Western people would say, like, oh,
weird,
very weird.
Well, and the interest in that comes from being able to see what's on the other side of facing that, which is why people do those things and face that. Because if you've had an experience where you come face to face with death, whether it be a near-death experience or just something that a death close to you or just within yourself coming to terms with the insecurity of life itself, there is a bliss on the other side of that, of surrender. Mm-hmm. I feel like is why those weirdos are probably into that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any encounters with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think I wasn't necessarily thinking about talking about this, but you saying that there is a growing use of psychedelics in the death community, in the end of life community. A lot of people who have are diagnosed with something terminal are starting to use either magic mushrooms or LSD in like a clinical space, because sometimes altering your brain chemistry just for those few hours, you can really sort of see what is there, what is the fear like, and what is kind of beyond this experience in the human body. And so there is a lot of really incredible clinical trialing around that. There's a lot of use happening. And I hope that just as, you know, medical marijuana has become something that's legal in so many places in the U.S., my hope is that that will increase. I know that there was supposed to be a vote on that in California in November, and they've just pushed it because of the pandemic, which is kind of like a little bit of a bummer. But, you know, I do really think that there's a lot of really incredible research being done there. And a lot of people have said that that their use with psychedelics has really shifted their experience with their own fear of death, their own experience with their body and life and meaning and all of these big, huge questions. So I'm curious to see what happens in the next few years.
Yeah. Has there been any stuff as you're working with, I know you were saying the other day you were reading about how to clean a body. Has there ever been a point where you're like, oh, this is kind of freaking me out, or you're just like loving all of it?
I'm pretty into it. I think the things that make me uncomfortable, like the most uncomfortable, like, for example, I've been present for a lot of women giving birth, and being around birth is something that makes me very comfortable. But to me, that's like watching a body do what it's supposed to do. Things that make me uncomfortable are when there's, you know, like, let's say there's been like an accident and there are things happening to a body that aren't like natural. That's where I'm like, oof, like this is really hard for me to be with it. I haven't had that experience with any of my patients, they're not my patients. They're medical patients. They're my clients. Mm-hmm. Got to get my language in right. Cause I'm not a medical doctor. So they're not my patients, the patients, my clients. But other than that, I think, when I feel discomfort, I want to just be with it to see what's there, because it, like I said, like my body knows how to die.
Mm-hmm.
when it's time, my body is going to die. There's a process in becoming a death doula of doing a death meditation where you actually go through visualizing my own end of my life. What does that look like? Like visualizing the different parts of my body shut down in the order that they shut down. Yeah. And then watching, you know, my consciousness leave my body. And that was the hardest part for me in the whole death meditation, was realizing like, oh, consciousness, like my consciousness continues. That's cool. It's this body that is that's the end. That the thing that humans call death is really just the body's timeline is up. And that's so wild because I've spent so much time with my body. I've spent so much time getting to understand the way that the person of my body communicates to me, says like, you're feeling this, you need that, you're hungry, you want sex, you need a hug. Like my body communicates with me, and it's taken me years to really listen. And so the idea that suddenly that conversation is going to be over, I was just like,
it's really hard to come to terms with. Well, Ram Dass calls it, I don't know exactly what his quote is, but it's like driving a car that is going to break down at some point, but you think that you're the car, so you have all this anxiety around it because you think that you're the car, and you don't realize that when the car breaks down, you're gonna get out and continue on. And so that's what creates all this fear about that, is as being identified with the person of who we are, Caroline, Emily in this body, being the separate identity. As long as we're identified from that place, we can't imagine what it would be like to not be that, to just stop existing. Like that's not something that we can compute. It's like the brain malfunctions of like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I don't, me not being me, what is that? And so it becomes scary because it's so unknown. So I think that's probably why psychedelics create such a powerful experience of releasing that fear, because you're able to see outside of the identification with the self and the body of like, oh, there's a space bigger than all of that, that's not the end of all things, that's the end of this physical form. Just like everything, like you said, everything dies. Plants die, relationships die, everything is born, everything dies. It's all happening at the same time, all mixed together. But it's hard, as long as we're coming from a place of I am this body, I am this person who has a expiration date, that creates a lot of fear and anxiety. I'm curious to hear more about, on the topic of that, of different things dying, death being more than just a body dying. What are some other ways that you've kind of come to explore the energy of death in other spaces?
I think I've since starting to really do this work, I've just seen death everywhere all the time in a way where it's like just noticing it, not necessarily like other people would look at it and go like, oh, that was a death. But for me, just being like, oh, wow, this thing is ending. And so specifically around relationships, that's been really interesting. And some of my relationships that have ended recently, I've realized it's really important for me to just name it. Like it's really important for me to, just like if one of our close friends died, we wouldn't just be like, oh, cool, look away. Like we would be like, wow, she died. That needs to be named. And even my mentor in the death doula world, she uses the word death as much as possible. She doesn't say like passed away or end of life, because she's like, we need to be with it. It's a death. It's the end. It is the end as we knew it. And so in relationships, specifically, I got a divorce last year. And that for me was really interesting, seeing how many parallels there are with death and with a divorce, seeing how many things, whether it's like the stages of grief, which are very real, and I had never really experienced them like that intensely before. And also just really seeing like, because the person that I was married to, and I had been together for 16 years, and so many people said like, what was wrong? You guys seemed fine. You know, so many things like that where they would comment on the way it looked. And I thought so much about that because, again, going back to humans wanting to understand and control and feel in control, people saying like, what happened and those sorts of things. They want to have an understanding, like they get it.
So they can protect themselves
from
that happening to them.
Totally.
Like, oh, I get what we're wrong, so I won't do that.
That won't happen. That won't happen to me. And so that was really interesting to then also think about it in terms of like the death of a body. Sometimes death for someone's body happens instantaneously, and maybe that's like a car crash, and maybe it's literally life and death. One minute they're alive, the next minute they're dead. And then there might be someone who dies very slowly, and it's something like cancer where they didn't even know. They didn't even know they had cancer until like 2 weeks before they die, and they go for just like a medical checkup, and the doctor says like, you have stage 4 whatever, and they're like, what? I had no idea. That is a different kind of death. And from the outside, humans would say, he looked fine. Yeah. He was healthy. Everything was fine. That doesn't mean that you can control it. That doesn't mean there's any more understanding about what actually was going on. And so I think the parallel that came up for me in relationships, specifically with my marriage, was, you know, there are things like, there are traumas in relationships, like an affair, a betrayal. You know, we hear all the time, like, what happened? Oh, well, he stole all the money and it was his fault, that kind of thing. But then there are also the relationships where it's a slow, just evolution process of people changing and being different. And we're always changing on a cellular level, in our minds, the way that we're processing the things around us. And so sometimes it's slow and gradual, and it's not, there isn't that blunt force trauma of like, what happened? What did they do? And that was really interesting for me to see, and to kind of draw the connection between death and the body and death in a relationship.
Yeah.
And really honestly, just like that, my processing around the end of my marriage and looking at how at a funeral, when someone dies, you don't get up and talk about what didn't work about that person's life. You don't get up and say like, Uncle Jim was kind of an asshole when it came to alcohol, wasn't he? Like, you just don't do that. You don't. You say like, Uncle Jim always, you know, brought me apples on Christmas Day and like weird stuff like that. And to me, when I got a divorce, I thought about that and how I kind of want that same experience in my own relationship where, sure, could I sit and tell you everything that wasn't great? Yeah, absolutely. But is that how I want to live my life? No. I want to honor what was, I want to love what was, and I want to integrate the lessons that I learned, but I'm not going to sit and go through like talking about the stuff that was bad. Just like when someone dies, we don't do that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to think about how we draw a line and create a distinction of like death of the body is death, but then death of a relationship is not death. It's this other thing that we treat completely differently when really they're more similar than not. And it would probably be helpful to treat those things a little more like we treat a death, because something is dying. What was the relationship that was, the dynamic that was, the life that was, is no more. And so there's a mourning process and a grieving process and all of that, that sometimes I think we look to avoid. It makes it easier to compartmentalize and say, oh, well, this is how this was, and make it oversimplified or villainize a person. So that way, because the person isn't dead, they're not gone from this space. And so in order to kind of almost make them feel more dead to you, I think that's why people sort of want to villainize them or make them, oh, it was this, to make sense of the fact that it feels like a death.
Yeah, 100%. And with my former husband and me, we had a very strong agreement with each other that we were going to be really gentle and really loving and kind. And so, you know, we didn't need lawyers and do all the, like, you know, a marriage story thing, which I'm super grateful for. But in that, there were a couple of times where, you know, we said to each other, like, and I understood and had so much more empathy for people who do demonize someone during a breakup, because it's actually harder to say soft. It's harder to acknowledge that there's still so much love there, and that this isn't, it's not just because something is dead, just because a body is dead and a, you know, the consciousness has left the body, doesn't mean, you know, you harvest a lot of organs when someone dies, because there's still things that are beautiful about that body. There are still pieces that worked.
Yeah.
And so that's such a part of death, is like, oh, this body, the person of that was in this body isn't in this body anymore, but let's save what was still good. Mm-hmm. And in a relationship, it's the same. And I think that was so hard for me to really experience that, because I wanted to be like, but there are parts that still work. Can't we make this work? And I think that what I saw is that that's so much like when people keep their loved ones on life support for a really, really, really long time. Mm-hmm. And the person, you know, yes, is their heart beating, technically?
Yeah.
But is their life in the body to the point that it's really necessarily worth keeping that person on life support? That's a really hard question.
It is hard, because it's messy and it's complicated, as far as, because we want to make death really black and white. And I think what we're getting at here is that it's not. It's like, it's varied, and it's the death of the body, but in some instances, like you said, there, it's not such a clean process of now they're alive, now they're dead. And I experienced that recently with my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's, and she was in a facility for almost 2 years, and we watched her just slowly go away. And before she physically died, she had not been there for a long time. Like, the person that I knew, the person that we lost, I said goodbye to far before her body died. And so that was a really interesting thing to process, is like, I'm losing this person, and this person died. Like, who this person was to me, the idea of them, their energy, like what my relationship to them was, that all can fall away in like little pieces at a time. And then even with her body, it was like little pieces at a time, as different functions of her brain went away and different skills that she had. She was a piano player. She played piano every day of her life until right at the very end, which is just crazy to me. And that was one of the last things to go. And so that was a death in itself. Mm-hmm. Like the energy and ability of my grandmother playing piano, when that went away, that was a death. And so I think it would help us to be able to understand that death is not just a body not existing, but the energy of it can exist in all of these different ways, because at the end of the day, it's loss. It's letting go of something that we were attached to, something that we love, that went away. Mm-hmm. And that's what death is. Mm-hmm. And that exists
everywhere.
But it's also a transition. It's like, it's not the end in a way. It's the end of one thing, which leads to a rebirth of something new. Mm-hmm. Which creates some hope, I guess, and some beauty in it.
Yeah. I love that you just said transition, because that was the word that had come to my mind of the next thing that I felt like I wanted to talk about, was just human existence is all about transition. You know, starting from the very moment that a baby is born, it's the transition from womb to outside of womb. And then, you know, going from like leaving kindergarten or moving, you know, or like whether you're a kid learning how to transition from using training wheels to not using training wheels, all the way through. I have a couple of really good friends right now who are going through menopause, and it's so beautiful and also a little bit terrifying to talk to them and hear, like, they're going through some of the hardest stuff of their life. And I look at them at their age and I'm like, oh, by now they've got it figured out. Like, by now they know everything there is to know. By now it's all chill. And they're literally like, no, this is rocking me to my core. Everything I thought I knew is not the way it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that really, like, human existence to me is how well can I be with transition? How well can I sit with what I can't control? Yeah. How deeply can I be present to my feelings, what comes up in my body around the unknown, around what I can't force anyone to do or what I can't even force myself to do sometimes because I have my own limitations. And so that transition is such a juicy word to me. There's so much there about transition and how, what it brings up for me and for you.
Yeah, because there's always a letting go in transition in order to receive what's new. And just the way that our brain works and the way that our body feels safe is we don't want change. We resist change. We would rather suffer in the familiar suffering than move into something that's scary and probably better, but it's new. And so I think that's why that's such a massive piece of wisdom in so many religions and philosophies and Buddhism. It's like the core thing is attachment and letting go, because that's what life is. In every moment where something is dying, something else is being born. Sometimes that's really big, sometimes it's really small, but if we can learn in life to be comfortable with that feeling, with letting go, with holding open hands for what is happening, realizing that we don't have control or certainty, and just taking that moment by moment and seeing the beauty that exists in that. Because I look back on all the moments of death and loss in my life, both physical and not physical, and it's always birthed me into something amazing and different. And it's, but it's always, that's not to diminish the pain of what it is to lose anything.
Absolutely.
It's so painful.
Yeah. And I think that what you're saying brings up the thought to me of just my hope in people really looking at the cycle of life. Like, it sounds so, you know, Lion King, but it's really real.
Yeah.
And my hope
is deep.
Dude, it's so deep. It's so deep and amazing. So important.
Yeah.
Also Beyonce's songs with, you know, the more
it's like, how many kids have been like introduced to death through Lion King?
Seriously. I feel like I was. Seriously. So important. And I think that with that, like with sitting with real, you know, real death and real mortality, really, if we can be with each other in real grief, that is what I think is it's almost like we don't want, it's like we don't want to get that messy. It's like we have to, I think it's very like Puritan of us and our culture to be like, oh, but we know that we're going to go to heaven when we die, so we don't need to grieve. Yeah. We can just have a smile on our face. And one of my friends who is from India had a funeral, and I went to that, their parent passed away, and I went to the funeral, and it was so visceral to be in a room where people were actively grieving, and there was sound, and there was, and I was like, oh my God. And this was years ago, so I'm good now. But at the time it was like, can they hold it together? Like, what is going on? Don't they know what's going on? But I think that grief isn't pretty. It's not this put together, I know everything and I can just sit here with my hands folded. It is, sometimes it's wailing, screaming, crying. And right now our society isn't quite ready for that. And I love the people like Liz Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, and she's gone on so many things. Like, her partner died a couple of years ago, and I love how vulnerable she's been about her grief. Like, sometimes you get together with your friends and you like shave your heads because you're in such grief that it's just like you have to do something on the outside. There has to be this like external process with your body to be with how much anguish is there.
Yeah.
And I really like, I really hope that we, especially with this pandemic, especially with so many of us going through such intense personal grief around the way that we thought our lives were going to work, look, the way that we thought our money was going to work, our careers, our summer vacations, you know, my cousin was supposed to get married this weekend, that's canceled. Like, the number of things that we have to grieve, it's not just the event that we're grieving, it's the meaning underneath it. And it's what did that mean to get to have a wedding? What did that mean to go on a summer vacation? Like, I was going to travel for 3 months by myself this year for the first time in my life after being in a relationship for 16 years. That meant a lot to me. This was like, it took me weeks just to get up the courage to say out loud, I'm going to travel for 3 months by myself this year. And now I'm like, I guess I'm not. Yeah. Like, I can't even get on an airplane. So it's not just the thing that's gone. It's the what else is there. And yeah. And I really hope that we get the courage to be with how uncomfortable that is and hold space for each other, knowing that it's not personal. If you need to cry and scream and be sad about something that really broke your heart, can I be with you and be in that grief with you without making it about me or I did something wrong or this is not pretty? Yeah. Can I just be with you and be in that mm-hmm. human existence with you?
Yeah. How do you think our relationship to death and our fear of death culturally is affecting us right now in the middle of this pandemic and the way that we're dealing with it?
Oh my, that's a very loaded question. wow. I think it's all over the way that we're dealing with this. Mm-hmm. I think that it's, you know, our culture wants to preserve life so desperately that to me, the levels that we're willing to go in order to potentially preserve lives. I mean, I'm not saying, like, let's be clear. I'm not saying that we should all run out. There are people that are, you know, protesting and going outside without masks and not social distancing. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying let's be irresponsible, but the level at which we are going, the prices we're paying, you know, the fact that kids in communities where their meals were happening at school and they're now at home in homes where they don't have the internet, they're not getting school, they're not getting food, you know, mental health, our economy, like, these are the prices that we're paying for what we're doing and the way that we're handling this pandemic. Do I have an answer? No, I'm not saying I have an answer that's better than what we're doing.
Yeah.
But I look at the way that we're engaging with this threat of basically death, like mm-hmm. pandemic equals potential death. And the way that we're engaging with that is incredibly death phobic in my mind, where we aren't necessarily considering the ramifications of these choices. What is the price that we're going to pay after this happens and even right now? And is that something that we've really thought through? Probably not, because we're just reacting to don't die.
Yeah.
Don't die.
When it's like a very difficult thing to have to choose between and weigh, that when we're already very afraid and avoiding death in general, and then now we're having to choose between letting people die and, you know, even in the hospitals and the places where it's gotten really bad and they're having to choose like who to let die, all of that is just gets to the core of what we just fear most, which is choosing to let people die. And that goes against everything that we intuitively and the way that we've evolved to be. It goes against all of that because it's survival mode. It's how do we live? How do we not die? How do we keep everyone around us alive? And so this is really pushing us to look at that and be like, man, at what cost is it worth protecting life?
Yeah. And like, it's such an interesting question. I love that you said evolution, because I said to my friend the other day, like a couple million years ago, we wouldn't have had the language to even say stay inside, wear a mask. Like, we didn't even have that way to communicate with each other. We would have all just probably died, mm-hmm. or half of us would have died, or whatever it was. But we have evolved to this place, and I think we haven't revisited what is death and what price are we willing to pay to keep people alive. And I think that when it comes to going back to death doula stuff, the number of times a client is kind of ready to go and their family isn't ready to let them go, the things that they want them to go through just to stay alive for those few more days, weeks, hours, sometimes it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sometimes, you know, it's very, very aggressive. And I think if we can start to really talk about this, and if we can really start to sit with what's so uncomfortable about it, then potentially we can bypass some of that and actually just be with each other when we can fully be with each other and really enjoy that.
Yeah.
And not take it for granted while it's happening.
Yeah.
But also be in the flow, like you said, the open-handedness of being in the flow of the circle of life and death, and not like holding it like this, like I can't let it go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I feel like what's underneath all of what is so hard about this moment right now. If you really start to, like you talked about how you like things that make people uncomfortable and like sex and all of this stuff, when you come down to the bottom of that, it always comes down to death and loss, and that's always, everything seems to trickle down to that fear within us of losing people around us, losing our own life, and we're really facing that in really very real ways. A lot of people are losing loved ones right now over this, and mm-hmm. I feel like it's important to be gentle and delicate with each other, knowing that that is happening and that there's a different perspective when you're looking at the whole and what's happening as a whole in a big picture versus the very real experience of all of the people who have had someone that they love die in that moment, in that relationship. It's like, it's so easy to just forget the rest of it. It's like, no, I'll do anything to not lose this person that I love. And mm-hmm. so that makes it really complicated. That's why people are saying all kinds of things on Twitter and the internet that's upsetting everyone because those are very two different perspectives. And if you're looking at the whole, it, what makes sense is going to be different than what makes sense to the individual who mm-hmm. has someone at risk that they
yeah.
love.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard for us to hold both of those things right now, I think.
Yeah.
Do you have any, I don't want to say advice, that sounds like too dismissive, but for all the people that are grieving loss right now or have somebody that they love that has died from this, what can we do ourselves, and if we have people around us that are grieving, do you have any insights around grief that might be helpful for people right now who are experiencing a lot of grief?
Mm. That's a very good question, and it's also like a whole conversation in yeah. itself. It's been really interesting to get involved in the death world and realize that there are the people who are like the death people, and then there are the people who are the grief people. And if you ask either one of them, they would say like, oh yeah, death isn't my thing. And I'm like, you're literally around grief. Like, yes, it is. But they would say there's so much going on in each category that there's camp grief and there's camp death. Mm. So I would say there's some really, really incredible resources around grief specifically. And I don't know if you have like show notes, but I can give you some of those links to put in there. Otherwise, just in the logistics, I would just say like, be with your grief and know that it is messy. Know that it isn't a straight line. There is no way to speed it up. There's no wrong way to do it. It's your process, and find people who are willing to validate your process, because there will always be someone out there who can tell you you're not doing it right, or it's taking too long, or it's supposed to look like this, or that doesn't look like my process, so therefore it's wrong. But find the people who are safe, who can be with you in it and not make it about them. And also the stages of grief are really real. Like, there are waves that are very intense at the beginning, and the stages of grief are not always linear. Sometimes you bounce in between the different stages. And so it might be, you know, months or years while it's really up and down, and then the waves get a little bit more calm, and it doesn't, you know, knock you out so badly. I think back to my own grief process around my divorce, and you know, there were specific days where I like couldn't get out of bed, and I just was so, so, so heartbroken that I was just in bed crying, and I would give myself that permission. I would, you know, send a few quick text messages to the people that I was supposed to meet with that day and just say like, I'm not doing well today, and can we reschedule? So giving myself that permission mm-hmm. and just being like, I am in grief and that is my reality. that was really important for me because I think it would have been so easy to just power through, keep going. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I can look good from the outside. And that wasn't what was going on. So to acknowledge my own experience and process, and to give myself space to be in it because I couldn't control it.
Yeah.
And so being just fully in it was the best thing that I could have done and can still do because it's not over. Maybe the biggest waves are over, but it's not over.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so hard to do, I feel like, especially when we live in a world that's always pressuring us to keep going as if we're machines, that it's just like, oh, no, you have to keep working. You have to keep producing. You have to keep doing all of this stuff. It's really difficult, I think. I've always known this for myself, but the more I'm hearing more and more people all the time right now just expressing how difficult it is to slow down even in this pandemic as we're all being forced to stay inside and not do all the things we're used to doing every day. It's really difficult, especially if you're feeling uncomfortable feelings. Then you're like, oh, am I going to sit and feel all this stuff that feels horrible?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's so hard.
Yeah.
To do, but it is so important.
Yeah, yeah. And I've talked about this a little bit on my Instagram and different social media channels, but there are some really incredible 12-step programs that are available because I know a lot of people's stuff is coming up right now, whether it's and realizing that they like to overeat when they're feeling feelings, or they like to overdrink when they're feeling feelings, or they turn to sex or love when they're feeling feelings. There are so many ways that we as humans avoid sitting with the discomfort of whatever the feeling actually is. And so it's like, oh, you know, cigarettes, or oh, sugar, or oh, sex, or whatever it is. And there are a lot of 12-step programs that are meeting on Zoom right now, and it's free. So I don't know if that's something you can edit this out, if that's not a good resource.
But that's great.
Yeah, amazing. For people, especially if they're noticing that in them. Right now, stuff is, like, coming up that we're not used to seeing in ourselves because normally we can get just kind of, like, go through the routine of life.
Yeah.
But those 12-step meetings are free and you can go by Zoom and just realize that you're not alone, that a lot of people are going through that, and get some really great resources to work through it. But that's something that literally there's, like, Overeaters Anonymous, there's Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous, there's Codependence Anonymous, there's Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. There are so many different groups for these types of things that we realize that we cope in ways rather than sitting with what is.
Yeah.
So if it's someone that is listening that feels like that might be them and they're seeing that tendency in them for the first time while being in quarantine, you don't have to do it alone.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I feel like that's a very valuable resource.
Hopefully.
Wow, well, this is a heavy conversation. I'm like, it's already hot in here and sweaty. And then I'm like, ooh, like just talking about death for an hour straight. So props to everybody who's still listening for like sitting in that discomfort of a really hard conversation. But
totally.
Before we go, I want to ask you some of my rapid fire existential questions.
Great. I love it. And then we can have like a Lady Gaga dance party to remember that. It doesn't always have to feel so heavy.
Yeah, everybody who feels really heavy right now, definitely like laugh and be light after this. Listen, I'll probably put a disclaimer about like listen in phases if you need to. But okay, so rapid fire existential questions. I call them rapid fire because it can be short answers.
Okay.
But they're not easy questions.
Okay, I'm ready, I think.
The first one is, what is love?
Ooh, God.
That leads into the next question, which is, what is God?
Ooh. Love.
There you go.
Has anyone said that before?
No.
Oh, hey, good.
People answer these totally different every time, and I love it. Why are we here?
That's so interesting. why are we here? Well, I think that we're here because of God and love. Like God wanted to create something out of the frequency of the universe and wanted it to be a tangible, interacting manifestation of love. Mm. And so we're here and we're here to play.
Yeah. I feel like someone wise somewhere said something like that we're here so God could see and love God's self, like outside, to become two in order to fall in love and be seen as something other. I don't know exactly what the quote was or why I read it, but I always like that idea.
Yeah.
It's good. What is our biggest mistake as human beings?
Focusing on what's not working and what is different between us.
Mm. I like that. Is this real?
You tell me.
Love that. Do you believe in past lives?
Yes.
What would you reincarnate as?
As Caroline, as this. This is all there is right now, so I choose this.
Amazing. Would you want to live forever?
No.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about death here, so I would assume your answer.
I mean, I will.
Yeah.
But no.
That question is assumed as this body.
Exactly.
This carnation, incarnation.
Yeah.
Do soulmates exist?
Many, not just one.
Mm, I love that. Okay, and then the final question of the interview is, if I told you that the whole world was listening right now and you could tell them one thing, what would you tell them?
I would say, if someone's standing in front of you and you think about what you have in common with them, how can you talk to them with that thought in your mind?
Mm. I love that. Beautiful. Well, where can people find more of Caroline? What are you up to these days? I mean, we're all in quarantine, so it's like probably different than usual life.
Yeah. Some days it's tie-dye. Some days it's taking photos of people through windows.
Yeah.
Team Woodnote on Instagram, at Team Woodnote, is the most direct way into my life.
Cool. I love it.
Well, yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
With me.
I know. Hopefully you don't have too.
I mean, you don't have any sweat marks on your dress.
Great. Then I'm going to...
We probably both smell terrible.
Probably true.
We're embracing it.
Yeah.
All right, beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Remember, you can always watch these interviews on the MetaMoon YouTube channel. And if you ever have thoughts, suggestions, requests, anything, just reach out to me on social media at emily.capshaw. Until next time, remember you are safe, you are loved, and you have everything you need within you.